Welcome back to a retrospective of Background Briefing's coverage of the emergence of the alt-right in Trump's America. Let's now go to a broadcast from August the 24th. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor's Force Scholarship in the Public Interest and is the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, Dangerous Thinking in Authoritarian Times, America at War with Itself, and his latest book just out is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Henry. And let's start with the broadest possible landscape in the sense that are we still a democracy? Have we crossed the Rubicon into plutocracy? Because it seems to me that you could make the case that not just plutocrats run America, but just three plutocrats seem to dominate our government. The two Koch brothers obviously have the Congress doing their bidding, and we have one billionaire, Robert Mercer, and his daughter, who seem to, at least they're the biggest donors to Trump and clearly have some influence over him. So where would you place us in that sense, whether we're still a democracy?
No, I don't think we're a democracy at all. I mean, I think that, and what's increasingly disturbing about the fact that we're no longer a democracy is that there's no longer an attempt to defend the notion that we might be a democracy. I mean, I think that what we have seen increasingly over the past few years, and especially under Trump, is a switch in the language. And it's a switch that speaks to the need to define, in some ways, democracy without any substance. And I think that, in other words, there's no attempt, there's increasingly less of an attempt to justify what we see in terms of policies or what we see in terms of ideology or what we see in terms of social practices in the name of democracy. Trump rarely ever mentions the word democracy, as you well know. It's almost completely absent from his speeches. And I think that what we're seeing in Trump is evidence of what we're witnessing all over the world, which is a worldwide rejection of liberal democracy itself. And I think that it's being replaced with a kind of populist authoritarianism that is, in a sense, very comfortable now with defining itself precisely as that. So rather than saying it's a democracy, I mean, we're now saying, hey, look, we need strong rule, we need strong leaders, we need people basically who are going to preserve a sense of cultural nationalism. So all the markers for an anti-democratic society are now being touted in ways in which even the discourse of democracy is no longer used to legitimate those markers.
So in other words, we've seen democracy be rolled back in the Philippines under Duterte, who's busily murdering people that he doesn't like. There's an example. Are we similar to the Philippines without extrajudicial murders going on?
I think that we're closer to places like Modi's India and closer to Putin's Russia. I mean, I think that and Orban's Hungary and Duda in Poland. I mean, I think that these countries are really similar to what we're seeing happening in the United States. I think that Duterte is the end point of the most extreme versions of this type of authoritarianism. But I think that when you have a president of the United States basically defending the actions of neo-Nazis in Charlottesville and white nationalists, I think you have to ask yourself, you know, in what way has the language changed so as to suggest that the very nature of power itself has changed? And I think in that sense, yeah, we are in that moment of populist authoritarianism, which is enormously dangerous. I mean, certainly we can't point to elections. I mean, I guess the real question might be, you know, what are the measures that you want to point to that suggest that a democracy even exists in this country? Do you want to point to elections? They're bought and sold. You know, you have the Koch brothers. I mean, you know, they don't believe in elections being democratic. I mean, the basic economic, political, and cultural institutions of the United States are now largely driven by corporations. You have the AFL-CIO leader actually joined a presidential commission under a guy who basically is as anti-labor as you can possibly get. So I guess the question here, where are the markers of democracy? I mean, how would you measure that now? How would you talk about democracy outside of certain limited freedoms that basically are as empty as the word itself?
Well, the countries that you mentioned that we're more like in terms of the drift into authoritarianism, Hungary, Poland, and Russia, in all cases, the way that the country was essentially taken over by Putin and Orban and the Kaczynski brother, the first thing they did was take over the media. So we do seem to have a kind of ministry of truth in this country developing with Fox, and Murdoch apparently speaks to Trump almost every day. Sinclair is now about to be made even more powerful than it is, and will be in every home across the country just about. And then you've got these minor, lesser players like Breitbart and Drudge. And of course, you've got wackos like Alex Jones out there, who apparently the president actually believes and listens to. So is that an indicator in terms of what you're suggesting?
Yes, it is. And it's an important point that you're making, because I think at one level, what it suggests, if you compare those groups to other groups like the New York Times or the Washington Post, you know, one might say, well, wait a minute, you know, you do have this press that now is basically pushing back against Trump. But what Trump has done is that rather than simply shut down the media, he's discredited the media and harassed them to such a degree that the notion that in many ways he's convinced a large part of the American public that they're nothing more than an expression of fake news. I mean, he's done something actually more pronounced and, in my estimation, far more powerful than any of these other nations. I mean, he's created a tweet nation. This is a nation of tweet. And he excludes them. He excludes them through his tweets. He excludes them through a cultural war in which he realizes that the power of ideas don't always work simply in the interest of resistance. That ideas can be used to basically, in some way, create a kind of collective hysteria and massive sense of fear that results in many ways a shift in sympathies away from the call for democracy to the symbolic necessity of what we might call strongman leaders, authoritarian types like Trump. So I think in that sense, he's far more sophisticated. I think the United States is far more sophisticated in polluting what we might call the discourse of freedom, collaboration, and dissent.
Well, Donald Trump would never have been elected president in this country but for the $5 billion of free media that the mainstream media gave him. I'm sure they're trying to redeem themselves now, but that's an inescapable fact, is it not, Henry?
Well, I think it is an inescapable fact. Inescapable in the sense that they're trying to redeem themselves. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, that they gave him $5 billion worth.
Yeah, of course. And they readily admit that.
Yeah.
And they played a central role, of course, in Trump's election. But I think what that points to is, particularly in the United States, is that the economic crisis was never matched by a crisis of ideas. So that you didn't have, alternative public spheres such as what you do and what others do, who were really able to expose Trump and all the contradictions for what he was worth, rather than playing into this politics of theatrics and distraction that really is what drives the press. I mean, the press, the corporate press, the mainstream press, is really about ratings. It's not about the search for truth. I mean, why is it that every reporter who's reading off a teleprompter today is 25 years old and looks as if they've just won a beauty contest somewhere? I mean, you know, it's pretty clear that politics has turned into a pathology that now organizes itself almost entirely around questions of money and aesthetics. It's a spectacle.
And again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is also the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, Dangerous Thinking in Authoritarian Times, America at War with Itself, and his latest book just out is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Now, of course, you mentioned Charlottesville, where the Nazis descended upon Thomas Jefferson's hometown. Recently, a young woman was murdered, and Trump, of course, said there were fine people on both sides, which he's obviously trying to get out from under that. He even lied about it the other night at a rally in Phoenix. It omitted what he'd really said. But what I find extraordinary, and particularly when I see these crowds, there's an African-American guy that's always been at all of his rallies. It's got an amazingly long rap sheet for all kinds of cult activities and capital crimes. and yet he shows up at every Trump event. This whole tawdry scene from day one is absolutely extraordinary. And to see him in this kind of bread and circuses mode, even, by the way, even his own people started to drift off because he was just repeating himself like a madman. But it reminds me, given that Thomas Jefferson Town was recently, Charlottesville was invaded by the Nazis, that Jefferson famously said, an ignorant people cannot remain a free people. And you're a specialist in pedagogy. Is that at the heart of our problem, is the collapse of public education?
I mean, I think you can't have a democracy without informed citizens, right? I mean, that's John Dewey. That's Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt said, if you really want to understand fascism, you have to understand something. It's really about what she calls thoughtlessness. You know, the ability to create the conditions in which people lose their capacity to think and to be able to hold power accountable. And I think that, you know, just look at the recent statistics that have come out about the Republican Party that is shocking. I mean, almost 50% of all Republicans now believe that if Trump refused to hold elections in 2020, they would go along with that. Over 50% of all Republicans now believe that higher education is more of a curse than a benefit. Increasingly, in a number of Republican states, they're criminalizing the possibility of protest. Higher education is being defunded. Public schools are being privatized. The media basically, we have Betsy DeVos, who is really, you know, comparable to an idiot, you know, who's now running the Department of Education and hates public education. You have Jeff Sessions, you know, who is really the great white hope of white nationalists. And then, of course, you have this thing with Charlottesville and the kind of press that it gets. But what nobody wants to talk about is that you live in a country that's rooted in such ignorance that even the dream of the Confederacy never dies. That, you know, that's constantly being reproduced. Couple that with the war being waged against women, against young people, against transgender people, against gays, against labor, and the attack on education, and you begin to realize that people cannot basically translate private issues into larger public concerns. That's why this attack on education has been going on for over 40 years. 40 years. You can go right back to the Powell memo. When they were very, very clear, Lewis Powell was very clear writing for the Chamber of Commerce. He said that if the right wants to win, it has to win the battle of ideas. And they understood that, and they built think tanks, and they built, you know, all these private institutions that now create their own public intellectuals. This is one of the few countries in the world in which most of the intellectuals we now hear in the media are anti-public intellectuals. They're not public intellectuals. They're anti-public intellectuals. And in some cases, especially under Trump, Ian, as you well know, especially a guy as sophisticated and as smart as you are, you know, you listen to these people talk, they're like babbling idiots. You think, oh, my God. I mean, you know, where do they find these people? I mean, do they have a high – I mean, they should revoke their high school diplomas. I mean, these are people that are that stupid for whom the truth is meaningless. And that the real issue here is to create a fog of ignorance that would not enable people to, in a sense, act on their own sense of agency as critical citizens. And I think you're right. That's at the core of the problem. Now, you couple that with a celebrity culture that confers enormous authority in the country and mimics almost every aspect of neoliberal ideology. The competition, the rugged individualism, only one person left on the island, this kind of warlike militancy that drives the collective fantasies, you know, these revenge fantasies that now sort of permeate every aspect of the culture. These are not just political issues. These are educational issues because they're really about the creation of particular kinds of subjects, subjects that are comfortable finding themselves living in an authoritarian society.
Well, that's the curse, I think, of social media. You could paraphrase Winston Churchill's Battle of Britain admonition: never before in the field of human activity has so much been said by so many about so little.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think for me as an educator and somebody who worked with Paulo Freire for over 20 years, and I remember he used to say, if you really want, in a sense, to create a culture of conformity and passivity and a culture of powerlessness, lead people to believe that they're responsible for their own problems, that there are no systemic problems, There are no larger social problems. Lead people to believe that the hopelessness and the despair that they find can only be solved in the image of some symbolic strongman who somehow will make up for their own deficiencies and all of a sudden then make the appeals and produce the ideologies necessary to turn what we might call protest into a kind of enormous rage and hatred that both is cleansing and at the same time employs the spectacle of violence.
Well, you've got the combination of social media and people retreating into their iPhones and not having any more human contact or less and less human contact. You've got education being destroyed by a two-front war, the libertarian Koch brothers on the one hand attacking public education out of their peculiar ideology, and then you've got Christian fundamentalists like Betsy DeVos who refer to public schools as government schools and feel that they indoctrinate kids into Marxism instead of teaching them Christianity and Genesis. And here in Los Angeles now, there are billboards all over the city celebrating, you know, against evolution, this anti-evolution idea of celebrating the book of Genesis. So it is a very peculiar time. But your new book, Henry Giroux, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, after having basically told us what is wrong, your book's tells us what we can do. So let's walk through some of your points there, because I don't want to leave people in despair.
No. I think we have to remember something. I mean, you know, power is not simply about domination. You know, it's also about resistance. It's also about hope. It's also about, in some way, confronting the issues that we need to confront in order to basically not feel alone and isolated and to join with others to collectively address some of the issues that are bearing down on our lives. One of the good things that we see in the midst of all this ignorance is that, you know, there are many people who don't buy this. I mean, you know, you have especially young people. I mean, I'm just so enamored with the resistance I see collectively on the part of young people all over the country, you know, who refuse to buy this anti-gay nonsense, you know, who refuse to buy into the bigotry and the stupidity and the ignorance, and who are very hip in many ways around this new technology and knowing how to use it and are able to make connections that often aren't made, whether we're talking about the Black Lives Movement or we're talking about non-revolution, the Bernie Sanders movement. And I think that where all of this has to really gives us hope is that I really don't believe that there's any hope in the Democratic Party. I mean, I think that the Democratic Party has reached its limits in terms of what it can do. It's the party of finance, and I think that young people are really raising the question, what will politics look like in the 21st century that not only includes our voices and our hopes and our aspirations and our dreams, but reinvents a future that is modeled after a kind of democratic socialism and not after a notion of neoliberalism that parades as democracy. And I think that once we can bring these various social movements together, as crucial as they are, under the umbrella of a radical socialist democracy, I think things will happen. I mean, I think we're seeing it happen. The contradictions are too great, and the assaults are too withering. You know, I mean, it's people are going to lose health care. I mean, people basically are going to find themselves in places they've never found before, because this is an authoritarian regime that has not only separated social costs from any sense of economic activity, but is immersed in the politics of cruelty and a culture of cruelty in which it sees compassion as a liability rather than as an asset. I have more faith in people than I do in that ideology. And I really believe that in the long run, we're going to see massive movements over the next 4 years emerging that give us a sense of hope and give us a sense of possibility.
Well, given the duopoly that we have, it's hard. You know, we know that third parties just don't make it, that the game is rigged against it. And you end up voting for the person who does you more harm than good, because of the way the system is rigged, as has happened a couple of times with Nader in Florida, and then recently with Jill Stein.
Yeah, but I'm not really arguing that route. I'm arguing something very different. I'm saying you have to have a long-term strategy. Right. You have to have a short-term strategy. You have to have one foot in and one foot out. And right. We push the Democratic Party as far as it can go in order to make sure that gains can be made that give people a touch and a glimpse of what would be possible outside of the Democratic Party. At the same time, you begin the long march through the institutions, the long-term organizing that's going to have to take place at community levels around incarceration, around questions of public education, around the questions of the public good. It looks bleak when you put it that way, because we don't really have a language that really embodies the kind of democratic struggles that we're talking about. And that language is in the midst of being reinvented. So, you know, I don't believe the White House is going to be charged tomorrow and everything is going to be changed. I'm not a romanticist in that sense. But I do believe that we have already seen models historically in Spain and Portugal and other places where the unimaginable actually happened, when social movements and labor movements and the new media and young people came together to reinvent a very different kind of politics.
Well,
and there's no reason why it can't happen in the United States.
Right. But what I was about to say was that the Democratic Party is an empty shell. They're having a crisis of fundraising. The Republicans are making money hand over fist. Nobody's donating to the Democratic Party. They're in a state of crisis. My sense is that if the Tea Party can take over the Republican Party, then the kind of people that you're talking about can take over this empty shell known as the Democratic Party.
I hope not.
Oh, well, then how else do you express yourself in a...
Oh, actually, wait, maybe I missed that. I mean, you're actually suggesting that a left version of the Tea Party could take over the Democratic Party.
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Because it's an empty shell. They're not,
yeah, I got it.
They're
yeah,
not
got
raising
it,
so. Any funds.
I actually think that's one possibility. And I think it's an important possibility, but I think if they do take it over, they can't just simply restructure it. They've got to reinvent it around a vision that's very different from the Republican Party, the Democratic Party that we have now, right?
Of course. That's the whole point.
Henry, I am certainly not against that route. Believe me, you know, it's not just simply thunder or nothing,
right.
You know, lightning and thunder or nothing else. I mean, I think whatever route we can use to be able to bring these groups together to develop a political formation that offers a real alternative language and challenge to this idiocy that we have now. Ian, it's going to get worse. I mean, this guy just jumps from one catastrophe to the next. And I think it's some, like you said at the beginning here of this conversation, you know, people the other night in Phoenix were walking out.
Right.
They got tired, right?
Yeah.
They're getting tired of this, the emptiness, the shallowness, the lies, the stupidity.
Right.
I mean, how much further can we go with this?
Right.
I mean, what degree does some of the claim to legitimacy have to take root, and where's it going to come from?
Right. Well, you know, it's an amazing situation that the United States, the leader of the free world, is a reality TV star, a racist, a bigot, a con artist, a delusional sociopath. It's just breathtaking that it's happened.
It's breathtaking.
And we all have to do what we can to undo this travesty. Well, Henry Giroux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ian, anytime.
And again, Abby, speak with Henry Giroux, the world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy, and he writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, Dangerous Thinking in Authoritarian Times, America at War with Itself, and his latest book just out is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. And that was an interview from Background Briefing, August 24th, 2017. This has been a retrospective of Background Briefing's 2017 coverage of the emergence of the alt-right in Trump's America. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.